Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to DSMA Live Rents Edition. My name is Bennett Dunlap, and my connection to diabetes is that two of my four kids live with type 1 diabetes. And like my dad and one of my sisters, I am on the type 2 continuum, which I mostly treat with a device called a bicycle. So that's my medical device for that. DSMA stands for Diabetes Social Media Advocacy. DSMA Live Rents is a program of the Diabetes Community Advocacy Foundation, also known as DCAF, whose mission is to connect, support, empower, and educate people affected by diabetes. Tonight is October 18th, and if I sound a little froggy to regular visitors, I did some hard work over the weekend, physical work. I did two 14-hour shifts of the Big Blue Test, wherein I was active in sanding hardwood floors in my house, and I, in the process, managed to get a froggy throat. So if I cough and hack, I will try to mute myself, and I apologize in advance for that. Anyway, today is October 19th, whether you're listening to us live or on tape. If you're joining us live, you can use the hashtag DSMA on Twitter. And I'm joined tonight, as always, by my lovely co-host, Lorraine Sisto. Hi, Lorraine.
Bennett, hi, and thanks for that intro. My name is Lorraine Sisto, and I have three children, which brings me to my connection to diabetes. My middle child, Caleb, was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when he was 3 years old, and that was back in 2007. He's approaching 13, almost have two teenagers in the house. Our show is called DSMA Live Rents because in the DSMA Live family of programs, of which there are three, our show focuses on matters of parenting and diabetes. If you're listening to us on October 19th, if you're listening to us live and you want to join the conversation, you can do that by calling 760-283-5150. Again, you want to chat with us, you got a question, 760-283-5150. We're going to move right to our introduction to our guests, and because we want to include him in on our news, so we're not skipping our news, we're just kind of shifting where we talk about it. Tonight we have with us Mike Hoskins. You may recognize Mike from Diabetes Mine, or he has his own personal blog as well, which is where I think I was first introduced to him. Mike, welcome. We're glad to have you with us tonight.
Thank you both. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We usually start off with our guests by asking them about their connection to diabetes, and you're no exception. You want to walk us through that?
Yeah, sure. I'm a type 1 myself. It's been about 31 years. 1984 in the spring is when I was diagnosed, and I was 5 years old and was not really new to the scene of diabetes. My mom actually had been diagnosed when she was 5 as well, so even at that very young age, which I very much don't remember, I do remember her being somebody who's doing, you know, her own diabetes things at the time in the early 80s, you know, a few blood sugars here and there and insulin injections. So her and I pretty much grew up doing the same thing together, at least, you know, from the mid-80s on. And like I said, it's been 31 years for me, and, you know, she's well into her 50-plus year mark, has a Joslin medal, a 50-year Joslin and Lilly medal, and it's pretty cool to have that kind of inspiration in my life, to have somebody to look up to like that.
Wow, yeah, that's definitely a unique relationship to have, being diagnosed, having it already around you, and then partnering, I guess, and growing up with that, with your mom as your partner in some way.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, growing up, and, you know, I think probably from, you know, maybe from 5 years until whatever you get into 12 or 13, probably that teen period. I mean, you you know, I think her and I were on the same page in a lot of different ways. And then once I got into those adventurous teen years, diabetes or not, you always rebel a little bit, I think, and something I certainly did as a teenager. So it's not something I wanted to really define me and define my life. So I really kind of slacked off as far as diabetes a lot. And I think that's where I didn't want to really talk about it a lot, even with her. But once I got into my 20s and so on, it was definitely more of a partnership of a relationship as far as talking openly and, you know, just laughing about a lot of things.
Right. And we've talked a little bit before about your mom and maybe how she handled being the parent from the parent perspective, considering that I am a parent of a child with diabetes. And just from your point of view, how did that go for you? Was it, you know, you talked a little bit about your rebellion, but how did she handle that and where was she in that? And what do you applaud her for? And what advice might you have for parents of what might not be the best strategies based upon your experience?
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, as a 36-year-old, I applaud her and really have to commend her for everything she did. But as a teenager, I think it was one of those things where no matter what she did, I didn't want a part of it. And I really rebelled quite a bit. But, again, I think it was a lot of where she grew up from and when, you know, how she went through it when she was young. Her mom, my grandmother, was pretty strict in diabetes management, and you know she learned and kind of adopted carb counting, you know, in the 60s and 70s, long before anybody in the medical community even, you know, knew about carb counting. You know, one of the stories I remember, you know, growing up with, and of course talking about later in life was, you know, how, you know, the great old exchange system. Where,
right.
You know, grandma would say, you know, oh, well, you know, she can have, you know, a piece of bread or she can have, you know, whatever it was, half a cup of ice cream, you know, and everybody, you know, was aghast. It's like, oh, you can't have ice cream. That'll kill the kid. What are you doing? And, you know, and then she knew the place. She knew that you could easily do the exchange and, you know, you would not die from having ice cream. You can indeed eat that. And, you know, I think that was, you know, grandma was kind of an early adopter of that flexibility that you need to be able to have in living with diabetes. And so I think that's something my mom kind of grew up with and, you know, tried to instill in me a little bit. But she really kind of backed off on the D management and didn't want to be as strict as grandma was, you know, what she had gone through growing up, and didn't want me to rebel pretty much as she had as a teenager. And I ended up doing the exact same thing. You know, in hindsight, in retrospect, I mean, it's, you know, her and my dad did an absolutely fabulous job with what they had, what they were doing at the time.
So not only is diabetes in the family, but rebellion is as well?
Apparently so, yep. fighting the authority of diabetes, that's the story, I guess. That kind of instilled that fighting spirit in me. You know, I rebelled in what I was supposed to be doing, but I also knew how to rebel against, you know, example, insurance companies when they said, no, you're not covered, or we're not going to cover to the extent you think you should be. You know, we both fought, and we knew how to fight up the ranks of the insurance company, and that was something I learned very early on as a teenager and has kind of carried with me over the years.
Cool. So it sounds like, you know, it isn't just you learned, I guess, to be innovative from your mom, but from your grandma, who was an innovator and early adopter of, you know, what we now take for granted.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, this was, you know, this was a time I didn't grow up with insulin pumps or, you know, definitely not CGM. And I didn't actually start pumping until I was in my last year of college, which was 2001. And so, you know, pretty much, you know, all the years growing up with grandma, I was on injections and anywhere from, you know, two a day to up to five at one point in my teen years. But, you know, Grandma was always very supportive, even when I wasn't doing what I was supposed to. And I was very close to her when I was growing up and, you know, through my mid-teens, big part of my life.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's such a different perspective than what we're usually talking about. I think more often than not, we've got a parent who we've got situations where there hasn't been diabetes in the family whatsoever. And you've got, including yourself, three generations of people who've been exposed to it. So your grandmother mm-hmm. being the parent of somebody. So what someone like myself experiences, like I'm feeling like the familiarity and the lack of overreaction that you probably had in your life, whereas, you know, a generation older than mine, there's no familiarity and probably a little bit of standing off because they're afraid because they don't know what to do. So, you know, they want to help, they do their best, you know, you come over for a visit and they're like, oh, I've got all these labels for you, and you know, they're doing what they think can help, but there's not a familiarity there, and there's a little bit of, I think, anxiety always. I feel like we've been going through this for a while, but in comparison to the decades that you have in your family, I feel like a novice. But not only that, you've got the familiarity, but just the having lived through it and knowing, and just perhaps just not really stressing all that much about things.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, I do feel very fortunate that, you know, I have a mom who, you know, was diagnosed so young and, you know, grew up with it and lived through those, you know, the so-called dark ages. I feel really lucky sometimes. And, you know, just my diagnosis, I wasn't exposed to a lot of the, you know, the DKA and you know, potential scary things that a lot of families are. You know, and then I was diagnosed. I was over at my grandparents, my dad's parents, for a weekend. I learned many years later, which is, I don't know, maybe 5 or so years ago, that I had actually been sick with the flu a little bit before, right before my diagnosis. And so now as research shows us, we're, you know, that's probably why that was the trigger, at least for me.
Right.
You know, but again, they call, you know, they saw, you know, I was, you know, going to the bathroom quite a bit and, you know, sucking down water and, you know, the Sunny D they had in their fridge, which certainly didn't help the cause. But, you know, and again, I mean, they told my mom, they came to get me, you know, on a Sunday morning, and red flags went up, and we went right to the pediatrician and then, you know, the children's hospital outside of Detroit here. And, you know, it was a pretty straightforward diagnosis. I was only in my 200s. You know, and that's just, I'm very, very grateful that it was caught so early on compared to the thousands or, you know, 900s that a lot of kids are spent, you know, days in.
Right,
yeah,
right.
It's interesting you talked about having, you know, a really good relationship with your grandmother, and, you know, I think that is particularly interesting in the context of what Lorraine was just saying about, you know, grandparents that maybe aren't as comfortable with diabetes, you know, when it's their grandchild is the first member of the family that's diagnosed. And I kind of wonder, do you think that played into your comfort with your grandmother, that she, diabetes was old hat to her and she could relate to you instead of being, you know, afraid of the diabetes?
You know, I think a little bit it did, but I also think that she was just, we lived very close to them at the time, to her. My grandfather had died actually just a month or two before I was diagnosed. And so that was really a time, you know, in her life that, you know, she spent a lot of time over at our house, which is actually the house that, you know, we moved into the house that my mom grew up in. And so Grandma then moved into a condo, you know, not too far from the house. And so she was over quite a bit compared to my dad's parents, who lived, you know, a good hour away. And there was that. There was no diabetes on their side of the family, you know, up until me. And so that was a whole different relationship where they were just not familiar with it and not comfortable. And a lot of the, you know, family gatherings, holiday events, you know, was, oh, we have to eat at a certain time, you know, for both Mike and Susie, or I'm sorry, for both Mike and my mom, you know, Judy. Yeah, not Susie, my wife. But, yeah, so, I mean, it was just a whole new learning experience for them. And, you know, that's something that you know, we spent a lot of time trying to educate them. And I certainly know my parents did when I was growing up, you know, those years between five and, you know, teenhood. You know, that was a lot of effort they put into that, of making sure my grandparents on my dad's side, you know, knew what feel was and how to care for me.
So, you know, as we're talking about adolescence and rebellion, there was, you know, I'll kind of go back to that news that I said we'd talk about as a trio here tonight. I saw an article, I think actually it might have been posted to Dexcom's Facebook page, and it talked about a study, I think it was actually managed out of Caleb's former Yale University in New Haven. They did a study. It was a group of teens whose A1Cs were less than desirable, and they used a monetary incentive, very small, a dime, I think it was, for each time they checked their blood sugar during the day. So it was a reward for doing a diabetes task that they really weren't doing very much of. And it proved successful. Their A1Cs went down. So participants' average A1C levels fell from 9.3 to 8.4 during the experiment. And so it just raises the question, like, is that a good way to deal with noncompliance, I guess, is what it would be called, and I hesitate to use that, or actually I didn't hesitate too much, but I'm like, oh my gosh, I just said noncompliance, because people don't really like that word. So I don't know. What are your thoughts, guys?
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating. I mean, I think that was a news story I saw within the past week or so, and, you know, it's one of those things, I think that sports a lot of people. I mean, I think, you know, personally, when I was growing up, that might have been an incentive for me. I don't know. I think it might have helped me a little bit. I don't believe my parents did anything like that, you know, financial incentives. But, I mean, I think I was docked. I might have been docked allowance, you know, at whatever point that was in my life, you know, 16, 17. You know, talking about driver's license, you know, was I able to, you know, drive the car as much or even at all if I wasn't doing as many tests as I should? Or I don't think we ever did A1C, you know, specifically. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting concept. I mean, it's each their own. I think that's one of those individual family things. It's, I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you think, Matt?
I wonder if to some extent there isn't the you're in a study, so you're paying more attention factor in there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was a double-blinded process where there was some kind of non-dime intervention. That would be interesting to know. Just a skeptic in me, like, wondering if it isn't just, hey, if you pay better attention, you do better.
Right. I don't think so. I think it was just 10 kids, ages 12 to 19, and they just weren't testing frequently. And the whole idea was, we just want them to test more. And it's not about the measurement of what your number is or anything, but just the frequency with which you test, and will that lead to better outcomes? And does this incentive, is that enough? I am presuming here, and it doesn't say this in here, but I'm presuming other tactics may have been taken before this and weren't effective. I almost think it's like a sticker reward system for the younger child.
Remember somebody, I think Jeff Hitchcock might have used the sticker concept to some extent, you know, for his daughter, maybe not specifically blood tests, but just, you know, kind of calm her down when she needed to get an injection when really little.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know what other people have thought about it, but I wonder if people think, oh, you know, you shouldn't reward based upon financials or something. I don't know what the downside would be to this. It seems like it's small enough increments, a dime per time, and I think there were other incentives if you, you know, were compliant for so many days and you got an extra 50 cents or something like that. But I think in terms of behavior modification, you know, this is a positive behavior change, and there shouldn't be a lot of negotiation. Well, if I do this, then can you give me $20 or, you know, whatever? You don't want it to get out of control. But if a little thing like that, you know, changes the behavior in a positive way, I'm all for it.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I think you said the magic word there is that it was a positive reinforcement. Mike had said, well, you know, maybe there was some docking if you didn't do it. And I would much rather see people turning around and saying, hey, I'm going to have an incentive for the positive as opposed to a negative reinforcement for the negative, the double negative.
Right.
I don't know. I'm getting too negative.
So then you must be positive.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. I mean, I guess I can see the other side, too, where, you know, somebody says, well, you shouldn't reward, you know, the kids for doing what they should be doing anyway.
Right.
And then once you stop rewarding them, are they going to continue doing it?
Right.
But again, I think it's an interesting concept, and I think it's worth exploring. So,
you're right. There is that risk. Hopefully, there would be other positive outcome from it, just pride in being able to manage your diabetes, knowing that you have a healthier outcome, and hopefully that would buoy the continuance of the behavior. All right.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think we're good on that topic. I thought it was an interesting article, an interesting conversation, perhaps because of the target audience, which is where my child is approaching, although I have a problem with him checking too many times. Caleb, you don't have to check. When Dex comes right in front of you, just stop. Anyway, maybe they'll do a study on that. So something else I found really awesome was this intranasal glucagon, which isn't necessarily news, but I saw a report on a study. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm overusing that. Effectiveness of use of caregivers. So not necessarily a parent, but someone who maybe isn't the primary caregiver. I think that's what was included in the study. And just the efficacy of comparing a traditional glucagon kit to the intranasal glucagon and how drastic a difference there was in people delivering the proper dose with the intranasal glucagon. And then even on top of that, the difference between people who just didn't deliver glucagon at all. So I think it was 6% of the people in the study didn't administer the intranasal glucagon, but 50% of the people using the traditional glucagon kit didn't deliver any glucagon. 50%?
Wow. Yep, that's crazy. Yeah.
You know, this is crazy. I actually had the privilege of being behind the glass for a portion of one of the studies of Locemia, which is the nasal glucagon. And it was in the news this week because Lilly acquired the worldwide rights, say that once slowly, Bennett, to Locemia. But it was fascinating because they were doing the human factors test. And in some cases, we were literally inches away from the people. So the study was, as Lorraine said, caregivers. So they would bring a person with diabetes and a caregiver to the study site, and they would have the person with diabetes teach the caregiver how glucagon worked and what it looked like, and then they brought them back a week later, and they separated them, and they put the caregiver in a room, and they literally had, you know, the typical, you know, the siren noise, or not the siren noise, that rah, 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 you know, the alarm noise that, like, the den of the worldwide criminals has been broken into and the Incredibles were coming to save them or whatever that sound is.
Yes.
Going, and that's creating tension in the room, and there's a dummy lying on the floor with a backpack. And they said, well, do you remember being taught what to do? So they would route through the backpack, and we saw all kinds of amazing things, none of which were good. We saw people pull out, rummage through the backpack, find a kit, take a syringe out, fill it with insulin, and give it to the dummy. We saw people, you know, find the right thing. Yay, they found the glucagon kit and inject without mixing it. We saw all kinds of amazing things. And what was interesting, and there's an article in Medical Device and Diagnostic Industry News or something like that, and I think it just came out last week, about a hidden benefit of human factor studies. And the benefit that they discovered was when they did this, they were just trying to see if people could use this nasal spritzy thing. And they discovered exactly what Lorraine pointed out, is that there was a tremendous number of caregivers that couldn't use glucagon, and most of them had no trouble with this nasal powder. So I'm super excited about the product, and I'm also super excited that I'm allowed to now talk about being behind the glass, because I agreed not to talk about it for the privilege of seeing it happen. Very, very fascinating study.
Yeah, that definitely is. I mean, glucagon is one of those things where it was obviously designed by somebody who's never had to use it or use it on somebody. And it's so great. I was part of one of the original, the initial studies, too, of leukemia in the clinic. So I had to kind of have, you know, myself or the doctor do it. So I didn't get to have the privilege of having, you know, Susie or, you know, a caregiver do that. But, I mean, it's just, it's so fascinating to see this Lilly, acquisition news. So hopefully before long, next year or two, we'll see that.
Yeah, and I just think that that's one of the things that, you know, we talk about the news so often here, and I think that's what one of the things that, I don't know, and Mike, please jump in on this, but I'm actually excited about the stuff that's going to happen because of the stages of development in. It's going to get to market in less than 5 years. You know, 5 years mm-hmm. is never, and this stuff is going to happen. Do you feel that way, Mike?
Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, you know, you hear some of these messages from, you know, some of the bigger organizations and say this is the most exciting time in diabetes. And it seems like almost a mantra they've had over the past 30-plus years. But really, I think the past 5 years and even the past 2 years, we're at a point where this is the most exciting time, because you've got things like the leukemia, you know, sniffable glucagon, and you've got, you know, the artificial and bionic pancreas tech, and, you know, these things that, you know, they used to be pipe dreams. We never thought we would get to this point, and now they're within our grasp. And that's so fabulous. It's really exciting to see that. And that definitely gets me more excited. I mean, like, you know, we've had, you know, 30-plus years, and, I mean, I'm a novice compared to some. And, you know, it's so fabulous to be at this stage and to be watching what we're having coming at us regularly.
Well, I have to say that I've always been a little terrified of what would happen if Caleb was at school and had a very serious low that required this emergency medical intervention. And wow, did that article really not give me any comfort whatsoever. So I feel like people in the administration who may have viewed me as an overreactor to have so much urgency about glucagon training and to do it properly, I feel a little validated from that, but very encouraged about the future and the safety that will provide everybody, including children who are at school and under the care of people whose first priority may not be their medical care. So,
yeah.
Well, and, you know, I think it's, you may be an overreaction to say, you know, that you were overreacting, because that product was created by a dad of a type 1 who had that same kind of feeling of, you know, there's got to be a better way to do this. And in talking to him, you know, his vision was, you know, not just to get away from the complexity of mixing rescue glucagon, but also to make it more widely available, more acceptable. You know, as any parent knows, one of the bones of contention in schools are sharps. And if you can take the rescue glucagon and separate it from a sharp, that de-escalates the issue. But another thing that he talked about was, you know, this can become like, you know, the paddles of life that we see installed everywhere now. You know, there can just be rescue glucagon more widely available, and it's shelf-stable, and it's easy to use, and it's less threatening. And, you know, the JAMA article, I'm sure you guys have heard me mention it before, 97,000 Americans go to the hospital every year for an insulin-induced hypo. So this is really a cool, innovative way to address that problem. Very, very excited about that little piece of news. What other news is out there? Mike, you got one?
Geez, I mean, there's so much all the time. I mean, it's, you know, it's one of the things I'm really excited about. I just wrote about this within the past week or so. Martin Wood at Florida State and his new research journal, you know, basically trying to weave in the patient voices and, you know, have it open access so, you know, anybody on the user end, whether it's, you know, somebody sitting at home as a parent or, you know, somebody who's living with diabetes, you know, and it says, what's going on in research, you know, today, they can go online and they can find this research journal and they don't have to pay that usual subscription fee, you know, or get the first paragraph and then you're cut off from the rest of the article. So this guy's been living with type 1 for 30 years and just doing some fabulous stuff and, you know, welcoming people, you know, to write in, submit articles and, you know, kind of, you know, bridge that gap between the medical community, the research community, and the patient side. And it's great to see that. I know I saw, you know, our friend Mary just wrote, you know, I think the first issue was in the spring, and she wrote an essay to go in that journal. Just about her perspective on, you know, keeping up communications. And that's, to me, that's one of the most exciting things I've seen recently in just, you know, kind of bringing the conversation together between all of us and not, you know, having little silos of researchers and doctors and on the patient side.
Yeah, and unlike the typical journal, it's not real stuffy. And, in fact, it's called Plaid. Yeah. In part because Martin's always wearing plaid shirts, and I think he just thought that would be a fun name for a journal. And I think the first issue just came out last summer, right?
It did, yeah. It just came out in the spring, and yeah. So it was about communication and diabetes, and I think they've got their next one coming out in the fall edition. I think he said it comes out in December, and it focuses on. I think it's pregnancy and family planning and things along those lines as the second issue. And just a lot of cool topics coming down in the next year from what he told me recently. So that's something, you know, on the topic of news and research, I mean, I'm just in love with the idea of an open access journal that we all can read if we want to. I love that.
Yeah, and I've always...
Did we lose Bennett, or did you guys lose me?
I still hear you, Lorraine.
Are you hearing Bennett?
I'm not hearing Bennett. There's,
Uh-oh.
I think he is. Talk about some, hey, Bennett.
Hey, sorry.
Oh, this is Martin Wood.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm just checking it out now. This is cool.
So I guess, you know, we're going around the table. You know, you guys both came up with something, and I chimed in on one, but it's probably my job to come up with one. You know, I don't know. There was the – well, you know, here's one that's kind of near and dear to my heart. FDA has announced, at least a device shop at FDA, which is called – help me out here – Centers for Radiological Health or something like that, CDRH, which is the device people, are going to have a patient engagement committee. And in fact, it is open for if you would like to comment on their idea for an engagement committee, or if you would like to nominate somebody to be on the committee, that's also open. So that's real interesting, and they talked about it a little bit 2 weeks ago when I was down at FDA, and it seemed like something that they, as an institution, were really interested in. So does anybody have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's long overdue. I think that's great what they've come up with. I think it's the first of its kind. It's going to be really, really cool to see where that, where that goes and how that materializes and what branches off from it.
You know, I think it's interesting that it's the device group that's doing this. I think they have been far more open to us as the diabetes community. They've done the two, what did we call them, DOC Asks FDA sessions, and we crashed their server with a second one that the folks at Diatribe ran. So, and I think that they've been pretty open. They came to Master Lab. I know that the head of the diabetes group got married the same weekend as Master Lab this year, so we're forgiving her for not coming this year, but maybe we can get her down to Friends for Life next year.
That'll be a good anniversary trip down to Orlando for a few days.
Yeah, they do touch and goes. The government doesn't pay for them to stay.
Yeah, I mean, that's been one of the great things over the past couple of years is seeing how engaged the FDA has been, with our community. And I think your work, Bennett, and Christelle, and I think really Kelly Close and the Diatribe team have just been outstanding players in making that happen. And I think Amy Tendrich has too with in the Innovation Summit.
Yeah.
And getting them, I mean, they've just been, I think, a lot of times you get that stuffy feeling of, oh, well, it's the government, it's the FDA, but they're not going to be willing to engage with us. And they've been very open, I think that whole team there has been pretty open in just being a part of things at so many different levels. The Diabetes Technology Society meeting coming up this week, Friday, and, the FDA, there's going to be one of the guys talking about cybersecurity at that meeting with the FDA. And I think that's just, it's fascinating to know that they're a part of these conversations in so many different ways.
Yeah, I think that it is very much a credit to them that they're as open as they have been to Amy and Kelly and myself and others. And I think that can only help us if we engage them at every reasonable opportunity and help them understand the issues that patients face and caregivers face and parents face. And I think that they're very open to that. So,
yeah.
I think that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. And a guy who, has my Night Scout set up and, insulin pump and CGM, and I'm a little wary of, I guess I'm old enough to be a little wary of apps, and they just really don't tickle my fancy as much as some other people, but I'm excited about the possibilities that there are with the FDA on board and encouraging some of those things, making it easier for some of those data sharing things to happen, and that's exciting. I mean, it's really exciting to see that.
I hope that one of the things that comes out of these dialogues, and I think it was clearly part of when FDA was out at the last one of Amy's meetings that I was at, it was an openness to talk about how do patients perceive risks. I think it's really wonderful to have that be an open conversation so that the idea of risk isn't in a vacuum. To say that, as we look at automating insulin delivery or automating dosing calculations, it's real easy to get caught up in the risk that insulin is a very dangerous drug, which it is. But that it isn't something that is, it is, well, we could take insulin or not take insulin. It's, we're taking insulin now with a lot of associated cautions and precautions. How can we make that process of living less stressful and less of a burden, and at the same time reduce risk? I think that's a really wonderful dialogue, and I'm really excited that they're engaging directly with patients at the Diabetes Mind Summit and with Diatribe and other avenues to do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things, too, I mean, I remember when the meetings, the FDA meetings were happening, you know, the committee meetings were happening about, you know, Afrezza. And it was just great to see, you know, yourself and Kelly and, you know, Manny and other people there, you know, talking about, you know, there are risks and we have to be mindful of those, but get this into the patient's hands. So let us be the ones who can decide whether, you know, we should, you know, make that risk something that we decide not to use something or whether it's worth using. And give us the power to make that decision for ourselves. And it's been really, really cool to see them allowing that to happen a little more than what I historically remember seeing.
Yeah, and I think it's important for anyone listening to note that there's a distinction between that a Afrezza hearing was the drug group at FDA, and this panel is the device group at FDA. And so there's a lot of moving parts down on their big campus outside the Beltway in Maryland. But I think that possibly that a Afrezza hearing is the best example of how patients and caregivers and medical professionals and researchers and ADA and GDRF and all the rest of the alphabet soup can make a really big difference. You know, I don't know if anybody's seen the room, but it's a big, big, intimidating room, and it's set up, you know, kind of like what you would imagine a courtroom to look like, you know, with two opposing tables and a dais of important people sitting up front and very, very high-level conversations going on. Everyone's wearing a suit, and they look like they're high priced, you know, by the hour people all over the place. And in the morning, I just felt like that drug was getting killed. Just absolutely, you know, getting beat up. And then I got up to stretch and I was standing in the doorway and I just made a comment to the guy standing to me of just kind of desperation of, you know, this thing's going to get killed again. Okay. And I turned and it's Aaron Kowalski from JDRF. And he's, you know, kind of like expressing the same sentiment. And then after lunch, 14 different people got up. 14 people got up and spoke about the importance of choice and the power of patients working with their caregivers to make diabetes more manageable for that unique individual. And while this may not be the silver bullet for everybody, some people may need it. And it was just amazing to hear the tenor of the conversation change in the afternoon and, you know, go from feeling like this is going nowhere to having patients and caregivers and our collective, you know, always talk about our diabetes care team of our educator and our doctor and our nurse practitioner. And all those people got up and said something. And it changed the conversation for the better. And I think that's the perfect example of what we can do as a community if we get all those influences together. And it was super motivating to be there, so I loved it. You know, you'd mentioned this a second ago, and I wanted to loop back to it because you kind of glossed over it, that you know, maybe you're a little older and it's hard to get you excited about apps, but that you're using some of the cool new cutting-edge stuff, sensing and Night Scout, and maybe you could share your firsthand experience about using them, and then maybe a little bit about, you know, how do you choose to share or not share what comes out of them?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've been using a CGM for, well, I want to say two and a half years, roughly. Had a, you know, had kind of a a crazy situation behind the wheel a number of years ago, and that really motivated me to get on a CGM, for the first time regularly. And then I kind of wavered between which one was the best. You know, did I want to go with my insulin pump, or did I want, Dexcom? But I ended up deciding that accuracy was better for me with the Dexcom. And so I went on that about 2.5 years ago, and have just absolutely loved it. I mean, it's kept me a lot more accountable. I don't use it all the time, especially when I'm traveling. I try to keep, hooked up and do that. But, days when I'm at home doing my own thing, I mean, there's a lot of times where I haven't been hooked up to it for today or yesterday. I think there's a lot of data that comes at you, and so it's easy to get burnt out on it, and you have to balance that out a little bit. And so that's one of the things I sometimes struggle with. And I said, it's a little too much, this time, so I'm going to disconnect for a day or two and see how that goes. CGM in the cloud, Night Scout, I've been using that for about a year now, just about a year. And that's been a lifesaver for me in a couple times. And when I travel, I tend to go low. So those are the times I share my CGM data with my wife, usually more than anything other times. And I think it's one of those things where, if we get to a point where we're sharing a lot of, text back and forth about CGM data, then, maybe it's a time to disconnect for a little bit. It's another level of safety, and sometimes I find myself a little too reliant on it, and it's time to disconnect. But there's other times where I wouldn't be without it.
When you say too reliant, what are you referring to?
When I find myself almost freaking out a little bit because my Bluetooth signal is lost. And I'm not sharing data with it, or I can't see my CGM results. When I start kind of losing track of the basics of management, and I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do now that, Dex is down, or I'm not sharing my data with Susie, from afar. And I think that's a time where I was like, maybe it is time to disconnect just to get back to the basics a little bit and, maybe just exchange text messages and say, hey, I'm awake in the morning and all is good and, life is going on. And not have to rely on that data sharing.
Do you ever wonder, though, Mike, oh, my gosh, how have so many people gone through life with checking 4 or 6 or whatever it is times a day and... which way does it go? Are we like, oh, my gosh, we have this wonderful stuff. I can't believe people didn't have this. Or are we like, oh, my gosh, we have all this stuff, and we're just killing ourselves with information, and people have been living without this technology for years, and they're just fine. I feel like there are both perspectives.
Mom.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yep. Yeah, and I think it depends on the day. And the situation. I mean, there's times I feel one way and times I feel completely opposite. I've loved all of it, to death. And I'm so thankful that we've got access to, to CGM data sharing and, just the meters we have now that, allow us to be, able to carry it with us, a lot more than the brick meters back in the day. I'm thankful for that all the time. It's one of those things, I think, it's each their own. It's a matter of what fits into your life the best and at what point does it start you're trying to adapt your life to the technology. And I think that's a totally personal thing that varies so often from day to day to week, depending.
Right. And I think is it safe to say that because of technology, the outcomes are better. The outcomes of today are better than the outcomes of 25 years ago. So it may be more intense and maybe more data. We may have a little bit more data overload, but does it end up in better outcomes, or at least one better outcome, which is better blood sugar control, and maybe there are negative outcomes, which are emotional, that aren't as precisely measured.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's spot on. I mean, I think the studies prove, and they show regularly that, you know, people who use CGM regularly have better outcomes than those who don't. And, you know, of course, you've got a lot of, you know, deeper, bigger conversations about access and, you know, affordability. But, you know, I think the studies show that, you know, people who are using this technology regularly often have better outcomes. But I think you can't forget the note that, you know, a lot of times it comes down to the person. You know, you have to be willing to use it for what it's worth and, you know, and do what you're supposed to. I mean, you have to calibrate, you still have to test, and you have to carb count and manage well, or else you're not doing anything for your, you know, glucose variability trends and A1C and, you know, long-term complications. I think you have to keep that all in mind. But I think definitely we've got better outcomes as a result of it. And, yeah, I think the emotional side is, that's something I think all of us have recognized over the years, that, you know, there's a lot of us who dealt with some mental health issues and, you know, just the coping behavioral sides that weren't recognized, you know, widespread, and they've become more recognized these days.
I think that's a fascinating part of the conversation about risk, is that burden, and I think you were very clearly alluding to that, and I just sort of want to like actively push that back, because you can become overwhelmed with data, and that's sort of a negative burden outcome of using the technology. On the other hand, you know, if it makes your life easier, if it makes controlling your blood sugars less difficult and less finger sticks, you know, that's the other side of that's the risk benefit type thing. And I think it's really important to do exactly what you said, is to talk about that at the individual patient level and not at the population level. I think these choices need to be made to make individual lives better, and that we're getting to the point that there's options that can be designed for people is really the key.
Yeah. And that's the thing, options and choice. I mean, you can't, as great as I, and I think we personally think all of these gadgets and this tech is, nobody can be forced to use it. Just because it works for somebody doesn't mean, you know, the insulin pens or even, you know, syringe injections isn't going to work just as well or even more effectively for somebody else. And I think that's the danger, I think, a lot of times the tech conversation brings, is saying, oh, well, of course outcomes are better and, you know, everybody should be using this. And you can't force that upon anyone unless they want it.
You know, Mike, we're coming up to the top of the hour. This is the typical time of the show where Lorraine and I both look at the clock and are stunned at we're getting close to the end of our hour. One of the things that's always important to us is to ask whoever we're speaking with, is there anything we missed? Is there anything that you would like to bring to the table that us rambling didn't get to? So what did we miss and what would you like to bring up?
Well, you know, I really think that, you know, the only thing that I haven't said is just, you know, I've been a huge fan of what you both are doing for a long time, since the very beginning. And, you know, I think a lot of times, you know, the adult type 1 community or the adult diabetes community have said, oh, you know, if you're not living with diabetes, you don't exactly get it. And, you know, and I used to say that, I'm ashamed to say, I used to say that quite a bit myself. And I didn't look at parents the same way as I do now, and as I have over the past few years. And I want to say that, you know, here, you know, parents are just, you know, they're my superheroes. I mean, I feel like I know a little bit, at least, of what it's like to live with diabetes, but I don't know anything about being a parent, and I can't imagine doing what you all have done over the years. And that, to me, has been one of the biggest revelations I've had, you know, in the past 10 years of being a part of the DLC, just you know, being able to find that newfound respect for, you know, what parents do each and every day. And so I got to say thank you to both of you for just having this conversation so regularly and, you know, having all of us a part of it.
Well, that was very kind of you. You're very welcome. And I think this was a lot of fun as a show. We got to talk about news the whole time, and I would like to thank you for being one of the cornerstones of diabetes journalism and where we turn to find news every time we do a show as we go read your columns. So thanks for keeping your nose to the grindstone and keeping that news process working.
Yeah. Well, it's always interesting. There's always something coming up. And I'm happy to say the FDA is more regulating, giving us things to be excited about over the past number of years. So hopefully that continues, and we'll see where that goes. But thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's my job to remind everybody that DSMA Live Rents has been brought to you by DCAF.org or Diabetes Community Advocacy Foundation, and follow all of the DCAF programs, including DSMA Live, the Thursday night show, the Spanish language show, and of course there's the weekly Twitter chat under the hashtag DSMA on Wednesday nights. We hope to see everybody there.
And Mike, you know, you have from the very beginning absolutely have been one of our strongest supporters, listening, promoting, encouraging. So your words are so kind, as Bennett said. That was really very nice, and it really means a lot to me coming from someone like you who has lived with diabetes for so long. Because it is absolutely true. I totally agree that, you know, we don't know what it's like to live with – I don't know what it's like to live with diabetes. I really don't know what Caleb goes through on a daily basis. And I have always been appreciative and valued the contributions and the support and the knowledge that people who have grown up with it have been willing to share. It's such a special thing in our community, and it's not something – it's benefited me so much, and it's not something I take for granted. So thank you so much for your kind words, for being there for us. And for us, I mean Caleb and myself, and as well as DSMA Rents. I really appreciate it. I'm glad we were able to have you on the show. It's been a long time coming. I'm glad we were able to finally make it work.
Definitely. Yeah, you know, it's a team effort. So I'm happy to be a part of it, and we'll go from here, all of us. It's been a lot of fun.
Absolutely. We want to thank Mike for being with us this hour. We want to thank all of you who have listened to us this hour. Mike writes over at diabetesmind.com, so if you aren't following them, go over there. As we've said, we get lots of our news from there, so it's a go-to place. This has been another edition of DSMA Live Rents. We thank you for joining us. We want to remind you about another DCAF initiative, which is Blue Fridays, and invite you to wear blue each and every Friday. On behalf of Bennett, DSMA's founder Charisse, and myself, we thank you for joining us, and we wish you all a good night. Until next time.